This meeting of the House Judiciary Committee will now come to order. It is now 1:16 p.m., Monday, February 3rd, 2025, in the Max Gruenberg Capitol Room 120. Members present are Representative Costello, Representative Mina, Vice Chair Kopp, Representative Eichscheid, Representative Underwood, and myself, Rep. Gray, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Before we begin, I would like to thank Sophia Tenney, the House Judiciary Secretary from Records, and Zach Lawhorn from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. The purpose of today's hearing is to gain a clearer understanding of how federal funds are distributed in Alaska, their role in employment and economic activity, and the potential implications if those funds were ever paused or reduced. To provide context, on Monday evening, January 27th, Acting U.S. Office of Management and Budget Director Matthew Vaith issued a memo authorizing a temporary freeze on hundreds of billions of dollars in federal loans and grants. By the following day, January 28th, organizations expecting federal funds found themselves without access to the money they had planned for. Later that evening, a judge issued an injunction temporarily halting the freeze, and by the next morning, Wednesday, January 29th, the memo itself had been rescinded. In a statement, White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt clarified that the memo was withdrawn to address uncertainty caused by the court's ruling. She also reaffirmed that the executive orders regarding federal funding remain in effect and will continue to be implemented. Although funding has been restored for now, last week's events underscored Alaska's significant reliance on federal dollars. No state receives more federal funding per capita than Alaska. This moment also serves as an opportunity to examine just how federal grants and loans are integrated into our state's economy. Several state agencies were invited to provide insight into how federal funding supports their budgets. However, they have requested additional time to ensure their testimony reflects the latest guidance from the federal administration, allowing them to provide a more precise assessment of any potential impacts. As a result, today's testimony will come from organizations outside the state government. They will share how much of their funding comes from federal sources, how those funds are used, and what effects a funding pause or reduction would have on their operations and on Alaska's economy as a whole. We will hear from the following groups and individuals today: Lori Wolf, Chief Executive Officer of the Foraker Group; Jasmine Boyle, Chief Development Officer of Rural Cap; Vivian Corthius, Chief Executive Officer of the Association of Village Council Presidents; Jocelyn Fenton, Director of Programs for the Denali Commission; and David Traver, former president, as of last Friday, January 31st, 2025, of the Alaska Federation of Government Employees Alaska. Now we will turn our attention to a presentation from Lori Wolf, CEO of the Foraker Group. The Foraker Group is a nonprofit organization dedicated to strengthening Alaska's nonprofit and tribal organizations. They provide educational programs, consulting, and strategic support to help nonprofits become more sustainable, innovative, and collaborative. Their work is guided by the Foraker Nonprofit Sustainability Model and their theory of change, which ensures they remain responsive and effective in supporting the sector. Ms. Wolf is joining us through Teams. Ms. Wolf, if you would please unmute yourself, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Representative Gray and members of the committee. Just want to make sure, housekeeping moment, that you can see my screen.
Yes, we can see your screen.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you for the opportunity to share a few pieces of information from our most up-to-date data on Alaska's nonprofits and their impact on the state's economy. My name is Lori Wolf. I'm president and CEO of the Foraker Group. I'm a lifelong Alaskan born on Elmendorf Air Force Base and raised in Anchorage, where I'm joining you today. I've had the pleasure of being at Foraker since the beginning of 2000 and 2001. As you just heard, many of you are already familiar and know about Foraker, but many of you may not know all the ways that we are dedicated to and prepared to strengthen Alaska's nonprofits and tribes. As both capacity builders and the state's nonprofit association, we are positioned to support the diverse needs of Alaska's board, staff, and volunteers in a wide variety of ways. It is our role as the Alaska State Nonprofit Association that brings us to you today. In that role, we are a trusted nonpartisan voice for the nonprofit sector, advancing goals that strengthen our ability to deliver on our missions and position us well to partner with businesses and government at every level. Specifically today, I hope to provide you with data to inform your decision-making and serve as a resource to answer your questions. In the last few weeks, the administration has rapidly issued an array of executive orders. We're not here to offer an opinion on those orders, but only to say that they have caused widespread confusion and are already having a significant impact on Americans and Alaskans, regardless of how they voted. Additionally, last week, the administration attempted to stop all federal funding tied in any way to those executive orders. It is no secret at this point, since I am already on the front page of the paper calling that action catastrophic, that we are greatly concerned, and we are not alone. The last week has been a whirlwind of trying to understand what happens when we face the potential loss of roughly 33% of Alaska's budget. Since the initial memo, several lawsuits were filed to prevent its implementation. The results have been a stay for some funds, but not all. And at this point, it's a temporary stay. The administration has said the funding freeze remains on the table. Importantly, executive direct orders further froze other funds not included in that memo, and they remain unavailable even though they have been approved by Congress and signed into law. FOIKR has sprung into action, as is our nature. By Friday, this page went up on our website to serve as a one-stop for timely information, specifically with an eye on nonprofits. We are committing to updating the site with current information for as long as necessary. Our colleagues at the Alaska Municipal League are equally ramping up information on the collaborative akfederalfunding.org website with an eye towards municipalities. We also launched a survey early last week to learn how the executive orders have or may impact nonprofits and their ability to serve Alaskans and Alaska communities. We received more than 150 responses in a few days, which is unheard of by our standards. I will share highlights of what Alaska nonprofits are telling us about at the end of my presentation. Friday, we also launched a more comprehensive survey to help us understand in more detail how federal funding cuts will impact our work. We are sharing that information with our congressional delegation and other partners in this work. We expect those results in the coming weeks, and we appreciate all of our partners on this screen who are also sharing that survey out to get as much information as possible from tribes, municipalities, and others. Before I get ahead of myself, I want to provide a moment of context about the data that I'll be sharing and where it comes from. This is our seventh study on the impact of nonprofit sector on the state's economy. Every 3 years, we embark on this significant analysis to better inform policymakers, businesses, nonprofit leaders, and tribes about Alaska's nonprofit sector. We are confident that we are using the best and most trusted sources available, both for raw data and research from the field. Please note that this data, which is from 2023, is the most current available for a comprehensive non-survey report. This is why we launched our survey last week to gather additional data that is current at this point to better understand Alaska today. Every day, Alaska's nonprofits and tribes deliver efficient and effective services to all Alaskans at a predictable and stable partner to government. Every Alaskan is a nonprofit beneficiary because nonprofits are woven into the fabric of our communities. The blue line represents how we travel in a day throughout our state. The Seward Highway, the Kuskokwim River, the Marine Highway System, or our favorite snow machine trail. It is almost impossible to go through a day in Alaska without connecting with a nonprofit. Without a county system of government, Alaska's unique structure means that in urban and particularly in rural areas, nonprofits and tribes deliver a variety of public services like water and sanitation, fire service, utilities, libraries, and public transportation, and even provide essential services like medical care and housing. They also bring us joy and purpose through art, religious and cultural expression, education, and recreation. They ensure our quality of life, sustain our way of life, and attract and develop employees to our state. While no sector can create a thriving economy alone, when financial decisions are made, organizational and public policies are created, or programs are developed, we urge everyone to remember that each decision will impact the health of the nonprofit sector and thereby the well-being of every Alaskan. Excuse me. In the context of this hearing on federal funding, I want to take a moment to underscore the economic impact of cutting nonprofit jobs out of our economy. The nonprofit sector directly employs just over 35,000 Alaskans. Counting indirect and induced effects, nonprofits are responsible for sustaining almost 55,000 jobs in our state. Indirect jobs result from nonprofit organizations purchasing goods and services from other organizations, as when a nonprofit contracts with a construction company for a new building. Induced jobs are the result of employees spending their paychecks on rent and groceries and recreation and anything else they purchase. Together, these jobs translate to $3.8 billion in total income generated by the nonprofit sector, which then circulates through the state, creating more jobs and a stronger economy. Based on the same economic modeling used in the Alaska oil and gas, fisheries, and tourism industries, when indirect and induced jobs are considered, the nonprofit sector supports a number of jobs that are comparable to the state's natural resource industries, which are Alaska's leading sources of private sector employment. Notable in our state, which relies deeply on government employment, one in five non-government jobs are tied to the nonprofit sector. Because nonprofits are not considered a single industry, we often lose sight of the scale of their impact. When the state tracks jobs, it classifies them by industries, oil and gas, tourism, healthcare, not by the sector where the work originates. Nonprofits, government, or private. It often prompts me in conversations about Alaska's economy to ask, who is doing the work? As the assumption is that it is just one sector or another. In fact, all three sectors are integrated. Nonprofits contribute to Alaska's economy by playing a critical role, often as the backbone within the state's leading areas of employment. When associations engaging in the policymaking process to economic development agencies promoting job opportunities, nonprofits contribute to the vitality of commercial enterprises. For the business community, nonprofits are often a vehicle for collaboration to improve the business climate or pursue shared objectives like visitor marketing. In other cases, major players in the industry are the nonprofits themselves, such as hospitals, credit unions, arts and culture organizations, and the state's largest electrical utilities. So now that we've looked at some of the services and employment impact, let's look at the numbers. All sectors in Alaska rely on the support from the federal government. In 2023, $38.6 billion in federal assistance came to Alaska, of which nonprofits received $1.21 billion. The largest share of the funds, $34 billion, went to the state and local governments, followed by individuals and for-profit businesses and industry. Last week, the Juneau Empire reported that 33% of the state's budget is federal funds. No matter how anyone voted, the truth is that Alaska relies heavily on federal funding in every aspect of our lives, and all industries in Alaska are leveraging those dollars in many ways to make our budgets work. When we look at how the $1.21 billion plays out in the nonprofit sector, we have some idea of how it is leveraged against other sources or used solely by organizations to carry out their mission. This data pulls from the 990 classifications with the IRS, which is imperfect language and categorization, but helps us get a sense of the impact. As part of their relationships with government, many nonprofits receive funds to carry out their missions. These funds are a factor in the financial health of organizations, and regardless of their size, they help leverage additional resources for a diversified portfolio to maximize community impact while dealing with the increased demand for services and a more complex set of challenges every day. Local, state, and federal policies and investments have a profound impact on the return on those philanthropic and earned income investments, each source of revenue leveraging another. This version of the chart illustrates that outside of healthcare, the reliance on government funding and private donations is even greater. Now that we've talked about the regular operating support, let's turn to recent acts of Congress to designate new pools of revenue to all 50 states. In our report, we celebrated these funds as a once-in-a-lifetime investment in Alaska's infrastructure. Many local governments, nonprofits, and tribes, as well as the state and federal agencies, have been planning these projects for years. They mean access to village-safe water, more affordable and locally driven energy sources, better health care, better or new roads, ports, airports, and better communication among many of our projects deemed essential by Alaska's communities. These numbers for Alaska are very hard to determine as they flow through so many different departments and come both directly and indirectly from the state. Local governments and tribes and nonprofits, this is only our best understanding of the money currently spent or allocated to Alaska as of 2023. We understand that there is or was much more budgeted this year and in coming years. We are hearing that many of these projects are in mid-funding cycle and delays will only hinder an already stretched and stressed workforce. Not on my list of funds is USAID funding that impacts the work Alaskans and Alaska nonprofits engage in around the world. That funding was simply not on our radar when we did this report. Those funds have been canceled or frozen. The funds from the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and the Inflation Reduction Act are frozen, and all projects are currently under review with no clear timeline for release, as we understand it. On Friday, 22 state attorneys general, not including Alaska, sued, and the courts released the funding, we think. We are not aware of what the currently looks like on the ground in those states, but we are currently seeking more information. We're glad to see the Denali Commission here, and we also encourage you to speak with the Alaska Municipal League and the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, among others, as they are well in the know about these sources of funding and their impact on Alaska. When we consider additional loss of funding, I want to put that in context to an already stressed workforce environment. One of the lasting effects of the pandemic is the ongoing challenge to find and retain workers in all sectors. Across Alaska's labor force, job openings as a percent of statewide employment peaked in the mid to 2022 at 12%, nearly double the state's pre-pandemic averages. While we're doing better than the national average, it is the nonprofit sector and government jobs that are bolstering our numbers. A funding freeze or deletion of funds only accelerates an existing issue. In the last 2 weeks, confusion and deep concern have grown as this is people's life work and their livelihoods, and they know firsthand the impact on Alaskans. Importantly, information is changing rapidly. The quick departure of federal employees means information and trusted contacts within departments are difficult to obtain. Many portals for accessing funding during the lawsuit stay have reopened, but not all. We understand that USDA Portal for Alaska and all SAMHSA funds, for example, are currently unavailable. As we tried to get a handle on the immediate impact of a funding freeze, we ran a survey from January 28th to the 30th and received 152 responses. They came from rural and urban Alaska nonprofits, tribes, and for-profit businesses, and from missions that represent the lifespan of Alaskans from infants to seniors. Groups report that federal funds are critical to operating revenue from core programming, and organizations reported that they rely on from 22 to 100% on federal funds to do those operations. These are just a few of the examples of loss that are listed here on your screen. Infrastructure projects underway are impacted, for example, the social safety net, food, housing, healthcare, childcare, prevention services that work on suicide, infant learning, education, cultural programs, science and wildlife research, health and individual safety, et cetera, et cetera. The list could go on. We also asked everyone in the survey what would happen if these funds continued to stay frozen or unavailable, and they let us know in no uncertain terms. We would see increased unemployment, a negative impact on the tribal health system, and increased rates of substance misuse, abuse, suicide, and domestic violence, a decrease in physical and mental health and well-being of Alaskans, including premature death. A push for Alaskans for higher levels of emergency care and reduced access to safe drinking water, nutritious foods, and education, among many, including also the risk of losing Alaska Native's language and culture through the programming that is operating. Again, this is just a snapshot of a point in time from 152 of the 5,500 nonprofits in the state. We anticipate that this is just the beginning. Before we turn to the often said thought that if we have no money, then volunteers can do the work, Our answer is, that's our current reality. The vast majority of nonprofits are doing what they can already with no staff, but it is unrealistic and even dangerous in most cases to replace professional staff with volunteers. Additionally, at 10 to 40% of the workforce across Alaska, this would upend entire local economies. Private philanthropy in Alaska also cannot make up for the difference in the loss of government investment. They are a leveraging tool, not a sole source option. The bottom line is that Alaskans rely on federal funding to sustain our way of life. I hope that today's information was a helpful context through ongoing conversations and those that come after me in this hearing. Under different circumstances, I would be asking these things of you in normal circumstances or normal course of business, to use the data, to work closely with nonprofits as your partners in this economy, to understand the essential nature of paying for all nonprofits, grants, contracts, and reimbursements on time, because we are in this work with you to help Alaskans. I still invite you to do all those things, and now I ask you to do it with more urgency. We are and can remain strong partners to serve Alaskans. I thank you for the opportunity to present today, and I'm happy to stay on with you until 2:30.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. Do we have any questions from the committee? And I just want to say up front that we're going to just take a couple of questions now so that we make sure that we can get through all of our presenters before 3 o'clock. But since she has to leave early, if there's any questions for Ms. Wolf now, we can direct them. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, thank you, Ms. Wolf, for your presentation. I have two questions. The first, just related to IRA and IJA funds, since those are the funds that are currently being impacted to Alaska nonprofits. Do you have an idea of what percentage of Alaska nonprofits receive IJA and IRA funds?
I do not. There is no one track to determine all of those funds. We would have to go line by line by line. So I do not have that. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Maybe perhaps we could get that in a follow-up. Thank you, Chair Gray, through the chair. As you have been working with your own lawyers and partners, do you have any idea of any legal recourse or ramifications of the federal freeze on your organization and other nonprofits?
Thank you for that question through the chair. I think the question is Foraker at risk, or just in general, what is the course for anyone in the legal system? I'm not sure of the question.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, if I can reword, are there legal ramifications or any legal recourse related to grants that were promised to nonprofits and other entities that you're aware of?
Oh, thank you. Through the chair, we know of two lawsuits currently working their way through the courts. One had its hearing today. Our partners, the National Council of Nonprofits, is the lead plaintiff to around the OMB memo, and that would impact all nonprofits and the funding that was outlined in the OMB memo. Again, that went to court. The stay was to today. It went to court today. We are still waiting on the ruling from that court case, so we'll have more information as we go. As I mentioned, our website will be providing updates as we get them, so that's a good thing to bookmark. And then on Friday, we are aware that 22 states' attorney generals filed a lawsuit and were given a stay or to release all of the federal funds that had been approved by Congress. That includes the funding in those special tracts of funding that I mentioned. Our understanding is that those funds should be flowing to those 22 states. But I'm not in one, so I don't know.
Thank you.
Representative Underwood.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf, for your presentation. I appreciate that. I just had a quick question. Has there ever been any data on any duplicated services that we may have in certain regions? Looking at creative solutions, if depending on what happens on the federal side, if let's just say they don't reopen up services for people and that funding stops. Has there been any data studies on by area, let's just say duplicated services, so there could possibly be consolidation so the people in that area could still have those services. I'm just trying to think of creative solutions along the way just to see if there's any data like that that's been studied on, if you're familiar with that.
Through the chair, thank you for the question. I have a list of every nonprofit in the state of Alaska, so I've looked at it, but I would just say, I think that the question really is, even in a consolidation mode, which takes a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of work to do any sort of consolidation, for-profit organizations know that all too well. And for sure, nonprofits know that as well. Any sort of consolidation would be an enormous hurdle to overcome in this case, a very short amount of time. And all of them require, the little C in our 501c3, 4, 6, 8, 12, there's 32 different kinds of us. And all of them, we're corporations, we're businesses, we still need to generate revenue and be funded. And so if there's no federal funding at all, I'm not sure how much it matters if we worked to consolidate, and there's no funding to do that consolidation. So while I appreciate the question about overlap, which, there might or might not be overlap in communities, and I think we leave that to communities to be the judge, I would just caution us against a solution that would take a very long time and be quite expensive.
Thank you.
And we'll take one final question from Representative Costello.
Thank you, Lori. It's good to see you on Zoom or Teams. I had a question about when the directive was communicated to you, was there also an avenue to have the funding reinstated? And if so, could you share what that was or might be?
Thank you, through the chair. I appreciate the question. I'm not sure I understand it. There are some funds, and I'm sure that our friends at the Denali Commission could speak more specifically to this because I know they're in it. There is some funds are, quote, under review, and they've been provided a checklist of questions to answer in that review process. Our understanding is there's still quite a bit of confusion in that process, and the timeline is also very unclear. And there's we understand no guarantee that even if you answer all those questions and undergo that review, that then the funds would then be released. So yes, for some funds, we understand there is a process. It's very unclear what that exactly looks like. And again, I would defer to my colleagues at the Denali Commission.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ms. Wolf, for your presentation today. We will now turn our attention to Jasmine Boyle, the Chief Development Officer of RuralCAP. RuralCAP, which stands for Rural Alaska Community Action Program, is a nonprofit organization dedicated to reducing poverty and empowering low-income Alaskans. As Alaska's only community action agency, they provide advocacy, education, affordable housing, and direct services to support rural communities. Their work focuses on rural housing, family services, and community development, ensuring that Alaska's diverse and unique cultures are respected while building self-determination and sustainable economic futures. Ms. Boyle, welcome to the House Judiciary Committee. Would you please take yourself off mute, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation.
Thank you. My name is Jasmine Boyle, and I am the Chief Development Officer at Rural Alaska Community Action Program, most commonly known as RuralCAP. Thank you to the committee for the opportunity to speak today. And certainly thank you to Lori and the team at the Foraker Group for providing that incredible baseline information. That also permits me to focus a bit on RuralCAP, and I hope share an example of one nonprofit and how we have managed the last 2 weeks. So for folks that aren't aware, RuralCAP is celebrating its 60th anniversary here in Alaska, and we have provided services around the state since statehood. We have a 24-member board of directors that is by federal requirement, reflective of the entirety of the state, and generally average between 400 and 600 employees a year in 60 communities around the state. We are a capacity-building organization, so by design, what we do and where we do it ebbs and flows, because often we hand work over to specific projects over to partners for sustainability. So we uniquely are built to ebb and flow with changing times, often for very positive reasons. I will tell you that the last 2 weeks have been unprecedented as a business person. Certainly, as Lori mentioned, there have been two different funding freezes, if you will, if we can use that vernacular, impacting two different things. And so, you know, Rural Cap operates 150 unique programs today, which means some of our programs are actually about hard infrastructure, rural development. Some of our programs provide actual services to vulnerable people. So Tuesday morning of last week, part of the concern was that the guidance that we received was through the media. We were not being given communication through federal departments. What we were told is that there was a unilateral federal funding freeze. And the first course of business for us is looking at the programs where we are providing care for vulnerable people in Alaska. We have over 20 Head Starts, which provide childcare and educational services in rural communities. We wanted to make sure those parents could go to work and those children would be safe and have access to education. We also have 225 units of affordable housing, primarily in Anchorage, primarily with people in supportive housing who need services in addition to that housing. As a business person, as a landlord, we have a fiduciary and ethical responsibility to keep the lights on and those services running. So for us, quite frankly, the immediate reaction was a cash flow challenge. We have a $40 million a year budget on average, and over 60% of that is federal funding. Not all of that money comes directly to Rural Cap. We're often a pass-through or partner organization for small government, tribes, smaller nonprofit partners. But for us, Tuesday morning began safe and well, and how do we make sure that our hundreds of employees around the state feel confident that their benefits and their paychecks are going to show up? I've heard from partners around the state in group conversations and reaching out one-on-one. People have already experienced resignations. People had no-shows at work following these federal announcements. Because as we all understand, employees have many options in Alaska right now. And often what we don't get a chance to talk about as a nonprofit organization is our accounting staff, our chief financial officer, our residential construction experts. You know, they're not beholden to nonprofit work. Many of them have very lucrative offers to join the private sector. So when the impression of funding insecurity gets out, or non-sustainability, we often struggle with retention. And that's not unique to Rural Cap. I think that's unique to everybody that runs a government agency or a nonprofit in time when talent is in high demand. Of course, as has already been shared by Lori, the guidance has continued to evolve. And so today I would say, for the infrastructure funding, which remains on pause, I don't need to share with Alaskans that that is concerning in regards to the build season, especially the further north you go. Failing to procure the right resources today does set building back, often years on end, if you don't get on the one barge to Uktiabik. Additionally, our contractors have other opportunities. And if we can't commit secure funding and timelines to them from a project management perspective, that does stall hard builds. And I think we all understand, of course, as Alaskans, that we are already facing challenges with housing and hard infrastructure. So none of us are incentivized to see that delayed in the private sector or the public sector. Additionally, though, what I had an opportunity to hear, again, not just for Rural Cap, and I know we have other speakers that will speak, I think, in a much more responsible way about how we're seeing this across the state as an aggregate, but hearing from clients who were not sure if they could bring their kids to a head start because they read something in the news, and being unable to provide them a clear and succinct response and timeline for when they could access care and get to their work. Additionally, our tenants across the board, those who are in our domestic violence survivor programs, as an organization with a very broad portfolio, we had a unique opportunity to not only hear from our own team members, clients, partners, but also sit in larger state discussions with many of the folks who will be presenting to you today, but also with our congressional delegation who attempted to set up calls and listening sessions to hear about this impact. I'm grateful that we're a larger nonprofit that has resources that are focused on this type of work. I'm able to track policy as part of my day job. But I think what was concerning outside of our four walls operationally was the number of partners we have around the state who do run very small, very lean organizations who did not have the time or human capacity to access continued information, changing guidance, but always the cash flow. And I certainly think that we learned that in the early stages of COVID, both in the private and public sector, that reliance on a paycheck for many Alaskans is critical. And even a temporary pause is unsettling. Today, of course, the guidance we've received through the legal process that's unfolding is each federal department will communicate with us whether they have a freeze, and if so, what that freeze is. So I'll point to the conversation that I've had with a few of our tribal administrator partners, smaller nonprofits. They don't have the human capacity as a workforce often to reach out to 12, 15 federal departments. Again, not all of them are that diversified, so they may not have that breadth. But while the pause has officially been lifted from that legal perspective, we are also still waiting to see when certain funding systems with the federal government will be opened up again so we can draw down money for things that we've already committed to. So there's still a mechanism in place that is lacking, where we're not getting consistent communication. And I'll take off my nonprofit hat for a moment and speak to you all as a business person. We signed contracts and grants with the federal government, and we committed to doing certain tasks or to achieving certain scopes of work. We hired accordingly, and we are obligated legally to carry on the work despite the pause. And I suspect that that's some of the challenge is, I'll certainly say, representing my nonpartisan nonprofit, federal guidance changes, so does state and local guidance. I don't think anyone's contesting that sometimes that change is useful. Sometimes that change is something that is a larger conversation. But I think how the change is rolled out and making sure that there's clear communication on what is changing, but also being sensitive to the timeline. This essentially happened overnight, and Alaskans are still trying to get the correct information to keep doors open, services flowing, individual employees paid across the state. And I'm very appreciative that in Alaska, we know that we rely on each other. And there was a tremendous coalition of people working together to problem solve across party lines. I don't think I heard anyone ask about politics. But keeping the lights on and the doors open for Alaskans in an unpredictable moment of our state history. I'm happy to answer questions, but I think the coming presenters will have some perspective that would be useful. But for Rural Cap, it was everything froze overnight, both the new work and the new development, but also the existing obligations that we have, some of which we've had for 60 years, in a way where it's unclear how we can pause our commitments while our federal government has paused its financial commitments to us.
Thank you, Ms. Boyle. Are there any questions from the committee? Vice Chair Kopp.
Yes. Thank you. And thank you, Ms. Boyle, for your presentation. And I think I speak for the whole committee that we're impressed with the professionalism and quality of the men and women who ensure the capacity building that nonprofits bring to our state, and we're just really impressed with what Rural Cap is doing. And it does not fall on deaf ears how much housing assistance you provide across our state, your local leadership capacity building that you're doing to support a lot of process and financial management and other long-term needs of other entities that you're servicing, and then workforce development. I guess, would it be a fair statement, Jasmine, to say that virtually everyone in Alaska is touched by a nonprofit in some capacity, or would you say, is that a fair statement?
I would agree with that statement, either directly as the recipient of services as an employee or as someone whose community benefits and alleviates public safety concerns, the care of our kids and our elders, even depending on your definition of nonprofits, benefits to our veterans, benefits to others who have provided the gift of service to us.
Thank you, Jasmine. Just one more, Mr. Chair, just a statement. It's, I think, you know, the presentation from the 4-Acre Group and from Jasmine Boyle with Rural Cap, just as a reminder that nonprofits are integral to our communities and the economy, and that this pause, this unknown period of time that we're in now, is something that we should all pay attention to. Because they are the true workforce multiplier, doing things that government was never meant to do, government can't do, and nonprofits do that so much more efficiently and effectively, and that's why it should have our undivided attention. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kopp. And thank you, Ms. Boyle, for your presentation. I believe you can stay on until 3 for further questions if we have them at the end, but we'll move on for now. We will now turn our attention to a presentation from Vivian Corthius, CEO of Association of Village Council Presidents. The Alaska Association of Village Council Presidents, AVCP, is a regional nonprofit tribal consortium that represents 56 federally recognized tribes in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region of Western Alaska. Its mission is to advocate for and provide services to Alaska Native villages in areas such as governance, economic development, natural resource management, education, public safety, and social services. Ms. Corthius, would you please unmute yourself, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation?
Good afternoon, Soundtrack. Can you hear me?
We can hear you just fine. Thank you.
Thank you. Before I start, I just want to say thank you to the two ladies that presented before me. Their information was really good. I appreciate the work that they prepared for and the impact across the state. So thank you to them. Good afternoon. My name is Vivian Corthius. I serve as the Chief Executive Officer for the Association of Village Council Presidents. I'm calling in from Bethel. Thank you for providing an opportunity for us to share information regarding the potential impacts of federal funding freezes. AVCP received the memo that we're talking about on January 27th, 2025, in the evening, late evening. On the 28th, the next day, I met with our board of directors in the morning. This memorandum caused quite a lot of concern for us. That afternoon, we held an emergency meeting of our member tribes, in which we had over 30 tribes and 80 people in attendance online. So just within hours, we had our tribal membership online to talk about that memorandum. The following I'm going to share are some of the observations of the impact and devastating effects of the one-day federal freeze, funding freeze, on AVCP and our member tribes. We learned from our experience with COVID, the pandemic, how to pivot our services and how and what we needed to do to rely on to work with our member tribes regarding this OMB memorandum. This is significant because tribes and tribal organizations in the state of Alaska have learned to work together closely and adjust and be very resilient in times of crisis. So I cannot underscore enough how we learned from COVID on exactly how to communicate and move together in our region. Some of the following I'm going to share about some of the observations again. First, this memorandum created chaos and confusion. Chaos and confusion was felt in emails, phone calls, memos, questions, and in meetings. Tribes in our meetings were looking for basic information, and we did not have it. The memo was vague and contradictory, and our tribal members felt it. The federal funding rug was pulled out from all of us. Next item that we observed is during the Zoom meeting that we had with our tribal membership, some concerns came out of directly from the tribes, and I'm going to share them with you. These are the things that tribes shared with us. Concerns from the tribes included tribes not getting enough information, basic information. There was confusion on what the memo really meant and specific examples of targeted funding freezes. Concern over climate resilience grants. So there were questions about specific grants that were not answered. There was questions about funding for senior or elder programs. We found that financial portals were shut down without any explanation. We learned that the government, federal government, was not familiar with our villages and our lives. This is directly from our tribes. The memo was shared of not just hurting the villages, but the whole state of Alaska. There was some concern over letting our congressional delegation hear impacts from the tribes themselves. Tribes taking actions. The concern over tribes taking actions through resolutions, tribal resolutions, or possible lawsuits. Tribes concerned about getting funding to the tribes for needed services. So there was a lot of discussion about actually getting the services on the ground. The disruption of those services to the tribes were a concern. Specifically, some of the issues included tribal IDs, concerned over drawdowns to the tribes. Many of them didn't have the opportunity to do that because the portals were already shut down. And tribes had concern about the shutdown of the BIA office in Anchorage. In addition to these, tribes had major concern about all the other federal funds to tribes coming into Alaska, including the Indian Health Service. Continuing on some of the observations, this whole memorandum that was brought to us questioned the protection of the special status of Indian Country and Alaska Natives in Alaska. That whole discussion came to the forefront. The whole confusing situation brought up the concern of that special status of tribes in Alaska with the federal government. Another observation, a question that was asked was, how can we protect compacting and contracting in Alaska? AVCP currently provides essential services to 56 tribes in 48 villages on behalf of the federal government. We have numerous agreements with the federal government, and we provide numerous services, very broad range of services. We have become experts in delivering these services, and if these services stopped, then what happens? Will the state of Alaska pick up these services where the federal government stopped? These are some of the basic questions that need to be asked. There are more basic questions that need to be asked and answered. We need to start these conversations and have them with both the federal and the state government. We work with both. Tribes have relationship with both the state and the federal government. And lastly, what I observed over the last several weeks, several days, is from our perspective, the tribal perspective, is that we will stay the course. AVCP and member tribes will continue to provide services to our membership. We are committed to staying this course. And like I said at the beginning, we learned a lot from COVID, and that ability to pivot and change course really came in handy over the past several days. So I'll end there and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much, Ms. Corthias. Do we have any questions from the committee? Representative Costello.
Thank you, and I really appreciate you being here before the committee to share this experience. My question has to do with the federal delegation. Have you found that you've been able to get some assistance in getting responses to help address the situation?
Yes, through the facilitation of the senator's office, Senator Murkowski's office with the AFN, we had the opportunity to share with the senator some of the same observations. So we have heard directly from the senator.
Thank you. Representative Underwood.
Yes, thank you for being here today as well. Just for my understanding, for your budget, what percentage of your funds is federal funds?
We have a mixed federal state funding model. I am not prepared to say what the amount is, but our services are significantly impacted by all federal agencies.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you, Ms. Corthias. Our next testifier will be Jocelyn Fenton, the Director of Programs with the Denali Commission. The Denali Commission is an independent federal agency that provides funding and technical assistance to support infrastructure development and economic growth in rural Alaska. Established by Congress in 1998, the Commission's primary mission is to address the critical needs of Alaska's remote communities, focusing on improving utilities, transportation, healthcare, and workforce development. By working with local, state, tribal, and federal partners, the Denali Commission helps improve the quality of life in Alaska's most isolated communities, assuring they have the resources to develop sustainable and resilient futures. Ms. Fenton, would you please unmute yourself, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation?
Hello, Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the invitation to speak, and thank you to the previous presenters who have well illustrated the impacts from any appropriation pauses. To respond to a question earlier, our understanding is that on Friday, January 31st, a federal court issued a temporary restraining order directing federal grant-making agencies to not pause, freeze, impede, block, cancel, or terminate awards and obligations. We believe that the effect of this temporary restraining order is that it bars the government from pausing disbursements of IIJA and IRA funding. We have discussed with OMB, and we do not expect to receive further guidance from the office. OMB is the Office of Management and Budget regarding our Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act submissions that we provided last week. So that's an update on that. I did provide a presentation. Would you like to run it there?
Yes, thank you so much. I think we can pull that up.
There's only six slides, so it's okay.
Okay,
to do that.
Can you share your screen?
Oh, do you want me to share my screen?
If you could share your screen, that would be great. Perfect. We can see it now. Thank you so much, Ms. Fenton.
I'd love to present.
It looks great. You can proceed.
Okay, great. Hold on, I've got my notes in a separate window. Let's see. Okay. First of all, I wanted to give some background on the Denali Commission for those who are unfamiliar with us. We are an independent federal agency that focuses on rural infrastructure development. Our key top mission is to deliver services of the federal government in a cost-effective manner in order to promote economic development with a focus on that infrastructure. We have broad authority. It essentially says that we can do anything in rural Alaska other than defense, and that allows that maximum flexibility to fill the market gap for rural infrastructure. We have special tools at our use by design. We have Section 311 transfer authority where we can take funding from other federal agencies. We have a non-federal cost share where we can provide that local match that's required by some other federal programs, and that's intended for those communities without a tax base. And then our funds are considered no-year funds where they do not expire at the end of the fiscal year. And that's for those more challenging logistics, more long-term capital stacking for capital infrastructure projects. In order to promote economic development in rural Alaska, we have a multitude of programs that focus on that sort of infrastructure. Our energy program focuses on diesel-generated power plants, more recently integrating renewables for that energy reliability and security. We assist with bulk fuel farm upgrades and understanding that when you can buy in bulk, you can decrease the cost of fuel. Health facilities, we had a pretty massive health clinic program in the early 2000s, and we still have some small infrastructure improvements and with the advancement of technology and other security issues. Transportation, we do rural roads, barge mooring points, and some small dock projects. Our Village Infrastructure Protection Program focuses on protecting the public investment in communities that are threatened by permafrost thaw, erosion, flooding, and more recently, you know, the increase in wildfires, landslides, and drought. Our water and sanitation and solid waste program focuses on, you know, piped water and sewer or other options for communities to improve hand washing and health. Our workforce and economic development is across the state with training programs, technical assistance, and other innovative projects to really encourage economic development in rural Alaska. Broadband project program really focused on bridging the gap between that technical assistance and having responsible, focused, and funded folks to apply for all the broadband opportunities that are coming into Alaska, and that's been quite successful. Housing, we all know that housing is in a crunch across the United States, but especially of concern in rural Alaska. And so we're trying to see how we can de-risk some housing opportunities in Alaska, as well as creating new subdivisions, doing, you know, planning or platting, and design of new community buildings, and then community facilities that can include gathering places or other multi-purpose facilities. Specifically to your question, we put together this figure of place-based Denali Commission projects utilizing IIJA funding. We have $50 million tied up in active and pending projects. $35 million has been obligated. $33 million remains unspent. And as of, you know, last week, we were concerned that that funding would have to go through OMB's review and approval in order to move forward on those projects. We are of the belief that all of these projects are not contradictory to the executive order on increasing America's energy. I don't have the title of that right in front of me. We don't typically have any projects that are a barrier to energy development or focus on, you know, Green New Deal. Well, I will say that we, again, are trying to implement or add renewables into our energy system for reliability, and it's just good business to do what we can. Every gallon of fuel saved can be helpful for rural Alaska. And then again, these projects do not include the closed out projects, which thankfully have completed before now. So, the key takeaways from any appropriation pauses, given that as of right now, we are moving forward with responding to SF 270, the request for reimbursements, and making disbursements using IIJA funding, and as well as new obligations. We are busily working away until we receive different information, and, you know, apologies to our partners such as ABCP and Rural Cap. If there was delay in communication, you have to understand that we're getting new information almost hourly at times. So, number one, I would focus on the 2025 construction season impacts. Due to funding delays, planned construction projects could be at risk of missing this upcoming season. The procurement of materials, it must occur in time for shipment to project sites. If the orders are delayed, materials may not arrive in time, then you can miss the construction window, and that would inevitably increase project costs. This is concerning for projects like some subdivision projects that I mentioned are in Nome, Village of Solomon, and King Island's new subdivision. These communities have a Denali Commission award to build 8 homes, but they face a difficult choice, you know, proceed with ordering these materials without that financial security, potentially risking bankruptcy, or delay that 2025 construction season altogether. We are hoping that they will be able to move forward with that, but it is definitely risky and a very uncomfortable situation to be in. See, we recognize the undue burden on tribes, communities, and small contractors who operate on a reimbursable basis. With that cash flow already constrained, these entities can't afford to front costs that may not be reimbursed. We recognize this situation is causing considerable stress for recipients, contractors, and federal employees. The increased administrative workload from responding to executive orders and navigating funding disruption diverts staff time and diminishes overall efficiency. It can increase costs, and it risks the loss of institutional knowledge if experienced professionals leave the sector. We are focused on, you know, there continues to be deterioration of critical infrastructure, and trying to focus these projects on maintaining or improving this infrastructure to salvage what we have in Alaska. You know, a lot has been built over 30 years ago, sometimes 60 years ago. And so we're really, unfortunately, in a very responsive situation as far as funding infrastructure projects in Alaska. Let's see, I kind of addressed most of these things. Match funding for other grants, the FEMA BRIC program and the Department of Energy's 40101D. Program. Denali Commission is providing some non-federal match, both through IIJA, our base appropriation, and some state of Alaska funds. Thank you to the legislature last year and this year for some funding for that. But when these programs are at risk, our funding for matching those programs is in question, and it makes it an interesting situation to be in. We continually are requested for, you know, some emergency funding. Right now, Fort Yukon is on, they're operating on one temporary generator, and we are hoping to get out some emergency funding to them through our IIJA funds as quickly as we can to get their generator back, their full-time generator back online. And then at the end of the day, we would say, you know, as far as mitigation, continually, you know, we're glad folks are trying to keep the federal government accountable, to encourage normal operations. But at the end of the day, we may have to look at balancing shortfalls with State of Alaska or philanthropic funding or bridge loans to assist that continuity of operations. But we certainly hope that it doesn't come to that. Again, thank you. We really appreciate the invitation. Thank you so much, Lori. You had a wealth of information there. It's been a joy to learn more from the other speakers, and I'll open it up for questions.
Thank you so much, Ms. Fenton. I'd also like to acknowledge that Julie Kitka, federal co-chair for the Denali Commission, is available for questions as well. And we'll go to Ms. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, thank you, Ms. Fenton, for your presentation and your work at the Denali Commission. I have a question on your previous slide when talking about the key takeaways from any appropriations freeze. So there was the mention of mitigation strategies, including balancing shortfalls with State of Alaska and philanthropic dollars. And I know this is just contingency planning if federal money is frozen for many of these projects. Have there been any discussions between the Denali Commission, the State of Alaska, and philanthropic partners on backup funding?
So we do maintain communications with the state in various capacities, specifically finding extra funds to fill in shortfalls at the moment has not been specifically addressed. However, we are also talking with philanthropic organizations and they are, you know, recognizing the funding concerns. You know, Rasmussen Foundation has reached out to some folks and said, hey, if you need, if you have a budget shortfall, you know, let us know what's going on and see if we can help. So folks have really stepped up to the plate to try to address some of the funding concerns. But so far, and I cautiously say this, we think that we're able to move forward with the funding as it was appropriated.
Thank you.
And Julie, I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
Thank you. I have a question, Ms. Fenton. So I had spoken to some construction leaders right at the new year who were very excited about the $1 billion in potential federal money for infrastructure development. And they felt very confident that that $1 billion was something that we could count on. Can you just speak to the, I guess, loss of confidence perhaps in that $1 billion coming to Alaska?
I don't think I can really speak to that, although it may be by design, the loss of confidence.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Underwood and then Representative Costello.
Hi, Ms. Fenton. Thank you so much for your presentation today. I kind of wanted to ask the same question that I asked the previous speaker. I'm just trying to wrap my mind around how the budgetary processes work for each different nonprofit organization, as we have some amazing nonprofits here in Alaska. Are you guys fully federally funded, or do you have – I know that you're speaking with other entities now, hopefully. Just wondering if the freeze stays frozen – are there other avenues in your budget that could be expounded on, or is that the main source?
So our main source is certainly annual appropriations. That's our base appropriation. We received a one-time additional appropriation of $75 million through the Infrastructure Investments and Jobs Act. We received transfers from other agencies. I forgot to mention, we have a $100 million transfer from the EPA for the Community Change Grant Program. That is in a bit of limbo at the moment, but we are hopeful that it goes through. And we have other transfers from other agencies for complementary missions that meet, you know, the rural infrastructure needs in Alaska. So I would say that is a highly lucrative, you know, business line as far as a federal agency for implementing projects in Alaska. We have transfer authority and gift authority. We can accept funds, and we have accepted funds from the State of Alaska, the Rasmussen Foundation, and other federal agencies. We can also accept gifts from other private institutions for complementary missions to implement I think that, does that answer the question?
That's a great follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you. Yes, that's wonderful. And then do you guys service all of Alaska or just certain areas in Alaska?
I would say all of Alaska. You will not see us oftentimes constructing anything in Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Juneau unless it's a partnership with a tribe. We're really, you know, focused on rural and remote outside of, you know, these main hubs. But there are, you know, there's technical assistance programs that may be based in Anchorage, but it's focused on serving the rural community. And then I also wanted to mention, you know, both receiving funds through appropriations and partnerships, we push out our funding through three different ways. One, priority lists, which we find to be very helpful for rural Alaska. So we're not making folks apply for funds and writing grant applications. And these priority lists, they meet, evaluate the energy and power systems around the state, the bulk fuel farms across the state. We've got the statewide threat assessment that looks at the environmental threats from permafrost thaw, erosion, and flooding. And then at one time we had a healthcare clinic priority list. Then the second way of applying funding is through an annual funding opportunity announcement. We are currently working on our FY25 announcement. We typically put it out in January, but this year we have delayed it a little bit, but hoping to publish that in the next month or so. And that's really the bulk of our funding that goes out, and it's a transparent process where we have evaluation criteria, list of eligible entities, and we go through, you know, evaluation and recommendation to our federal co-chair on the top projects to award. And then the third way is through partnership opportunities where maybe our partner has an existing program and we choose to fund into that program because of, you know, one reason or another. You know, they have a solid justification for going to have like directed funding in a certain way.
Thank you.
Representative Costello.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Fenton, for your presentation. Certainly the Denali Commission has such a wide breadth of what you provide to Alaskans. It's really quite impressive. I'm interested in the workforce training programs that you have, if you could share a little bit more about that.
Sure. The workforce training, I would say workforce development really has quite a breadth of applications. Something small like we had a Caterpillar maintenance and repair week-long training course in NOATAC. It was a quick burn grant to that community to really focus on the repairs of their equipment to, you know, make that more sustainable and extend the longevity of their equipment. Two, we partner with other training programs, such as, you know, Rural Cap or Bering Strait or Bristol Bay. We have some other partnerships where they're getting into that the technical training, their post-secondary education training. We also partner with the university system in various communities, trying to get folks into challenge-based learning and project-based learning. So folks come in from I'm recovering from a cold. They come in from a community with a challenge that they have that they want to solve in their community. And so that's really an exciting program. And I'm sure I'm missing a number of other things. I think we also have rural management through the Alaska Pacific University that focuses on getting more managers of projects out into communities. And then I would also say we have some individuals, you know, we help communities hire a project manager or sometimes a grants manager and help get them trained up so then they're able to navigate the federal system, the grant system, and really, you know, either develop projects that are fundable for, you know, federal funds or other funds, and then implement and complete these projects in rural Alaska.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Aisha, did you have a question?
I did, but it was answered in that dialogue. Thank you.
Okay. One final question from Representative Underwood, and we'll move on to our next presenter.
This is just a quick one. I heard you say there was possibly this was listed on your website, but I just wanted to clarify just in case. Are there any businesses, entities, corporations, private businesses that are not allowed to partner with you for one reason or another for allocated funds?
So we typically do not write grants to for-profit entities except for ANCSA regional corporations. But I would say for the most part, you know, it's, you know, tribes, tribal governments, nonprofits, university, higher education, and healthcare, and state of Alaska.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Fenton. Our next testifier will be David Traver, the former president of the American Federation of Government Employees Alaska Chapter and current chief union steward for that organization. Just a note, the AFGE is the primary union at the Alaska VA. Mr. Traver, would you please unmute yourself, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation?
Thank you, Chairman Gray. As said, my name is David Traver. I am the newly retired president of AFG Local 3028, and I have agreed to stay on as the chief steward during these difficult times. I really appreciate a lot of the folks that have spoke today, and actually my family members have benefited from some of these programs. I have two sons that benefited from the programs that grew up with autism, and if it wasn't for the programs that are offered through some of these nonprofits, my children wouldn't have grown up to be the wonderful and amazing young men that they are. And there's a lot of families out there that depend on it. Speaking in relation to federal employees in the state of Alaska, there's 11,078 federal employees in the state of Alaska. We're currently looking at an executive order to terminate or, well, basically, yeah, let's just cut to the chase, terminate at least 5 to 10% of the federal workforce in Alaska. What would that mean? They would be starting out looking at probationary employees. Why is that an important demographic? Because currently there's 1,198 federal employees in Alaska with less than 1 year. Why is that important? Because most federal employees are on a one-year probationary status, unless you're medical. Chairman Gray would know that medical personnel within the VA are on probation for 2 years. So that's a number that's left off of here. So currently 1,198 in Alaska with less than a year, 335 of those are veterans. If those employees are let go, total lost wages to the state of Alaska, $88,898,788. Those are just probationary employees. Currently out there is a solicitation for voluntary resignations, not voluntary retirements, voluntary resignations. The impact is going to be chilling. Just to give you a little more history on myself, I have retired at the VA with 35 years, 30 of those federal. The rest, I served in the United States Coast Guard with an honorable discharge. I was born in Alaska. I've been a lifelong Republican. I'm one of the few conservative Republican union presidents at the time that I took office in 2016. The numbers started to grow. That has declined. But we're still going to push forward. We believe in the big tent. We believe, as I have often said when I was a president of the union, we represent everybody. And we're there to fulfill Lincoln's promise to serve our veterans. But with the services and the things that we're looking at having cut and the employees that I served, it's very chilling. Very chilling. And I'm grateful to our friends and family in rural Alaska who take care of our veterans there as well. But I had the pleasure when I first started out in the union of going to D.C. and advocating for VA employees' issues so that we could take care of our veterans. And I had the honor of sitting down for the first time as a lobbyist with Ted Stevens. And I have never forgotten the hope and inspiration that he instilled in me to continue the work. And as well as Congressman Don Young, who stated to me in a meeting one day, he said, David, the union is the canary in the coal mine. We need you. You are the only one that'll step up and tell us when something's wrong. And that is true. In fact, let me tell you something. We used to go to D.C. and take management's issues as our own because they weren't allowed. And we would just put the union's name on it because we care about the veterans. And often, when I would meet with new employees, I would say that management's goal and the union's are the same. We want qualified, trained employees that can provide the services that our veterans deserve and earned. I get those services as well. I'm a disabled veteran. If you guys say something, I keep talking, just put your hand up because I have hearing aids. Sorry. You know, I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I was born here. I was born here in 1965. My father came to the state in 1957 with the Air Force. I care very much about the services that the federal employees I represent give to our veterans every day. And the fact that we're looking at a reduction in force, however you want to put it, it's chilling. Matter of fact, 3 years ago, with the help of Senator Sullivan, Senator Murkowski, and Congressman Young at the time, before he passed away, we advocated to raise the number of federal employees at the Alaska VA so that we could care for those veterans. I believe that will change with the expectation of do more with less. That's unacceptable. Our veterans deserve better.
Thank you, Mr. Traver. I'm just going to interrupt with a question. You mentioned the 11,078 federal employees in Alaska. Do you know how many of them received the offer of the voluntary resignations?
All of them, to my knowledge. But the strangest thing is not all at the same time. In fact, one of the out of those probationary employees, 335 of those probationary employees that are facing possible termination, 335 were veterans. Let's see. I have some other stuff for you guys. And one of the things one of the other presenters was talking about was different government portals that they were seeking information from being shut down. We found that at the agency as well for our people. Certain portals where you click to go for information have been shut down with no explanation. Yes, I retired last Friday. I can tell you my phone has not stopped ringing with staff that are scared. We have staff prepping the resumes, looking for work elsewhere, nurses, providers. And I'd like to thank Chairman Gray for his service at the VA. It was a pleasure and an honor working with you as an employee when you were there.
Thank you. Do we have other questions from the committee? Representative Costello.
Thank you. And I hear often that when people retire, they find themselves busier, and it sounds like that's true for you, certainly. My question has to do with, is there some way to hold harmless veterans in some of these actions that are being proposed?
I don't understand, ma'am.
Well, I was just curious if there is a way to hold veterans harmless from some of the actions that are being proposed.
That's going to be difficult to say, to answer, because I don't know if the answer could be yes, because with staff being reduced that we represent, we don't know exactly where the greatest impacts are going to be. Generally, you would believe it would be that they would go after the low-hanging fruit first. And forgive me if I say this, GS-4s, 5s, and 6s, those are government employees at the fourth level. So the problem there is if you start terminating low-level employees, you're going to have an expectation that the staff that we represent at the higher level, the nurses and the providers, will have to do more with less when there is a pressure to see more patients with less time. I don't see how this is possible. And the stress that the staff are under, that they're coming to the union. In fact, I will be honest with you, I have more management coming to the union asking questions because they're not getting answers out of DC.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. I have a general question to the presenters, and I'm not quite sure who to ask, but I'm curious with the deferred resignations and potential turnover that we're seeing in the federal government, how that's impacting the TA provided to federal grants. Another way to ask this question is, since about a week ago, since there's been the offer of these resignations, how has that changed the process for different organizations to work with the federal government on those grants and figure out that communication?
One would have to believe that certain programs within the administration, such as rural health, would more than likely be impacted by such actions, but not something necessarily the union has involvement in, as that's a very small section within the VA that deals with reaching out to the tribal health consortiums and other groups of that nature to ensure that our veterans are taken care of in the rural communities. The loss of funds is going to be deep reaching, especially for our veterans in rural Alaska. As a veteran, I am deeply concerned and offended by that thought that my fellow veteran in Bethel, Kotzebue, Akuyuvik cannot get care. That's chilling. That's frightening. The thought of somebody who served their country honorably not being able to be taken care of. And I will tell you, I have never met a VA employee that I represented that went there to get rich. They went there to give back. We've all gone there and dedicated our lives to serving our veterans because we wanted to give back. And right now, what's happening is chilling. It's chilling, folks.
Thank you, Mr. Traver. We'll go to Jasmine Boyle from RollCap.
Thank you for the opportunity to respond to the question through the chair. I know we've been notified that even with the guidance and news sources saying there isn't a federal freeze right now, go ahead, work department by department. You know, there were already staff shortages with different departments in the federal government, and what we've been told for an extended amount of time, but what has heightened more recently is that we can expect things to slow down. So what that looks like for rural CAP and partners that we work with most closely is a little bit longer for the environmental inspection, a little bit longer for the HUD loans to be approved for someone to move into a home. Just the bureaucracy and administration of complex programs will be a bit slower. But with the heightened interest around the encouragement around resignations and the new gaps in different federal partner organizations, we've been warned to plan around that financially for more than one department. And I think there was an earlier question about how the money flows. I'll say the majority of our federal funds and certainly state funds tend to be reimbursement. So in the world of nonprofit, while we have a contract or a grant that says this is how much funding you're getting and how it will be dispersed to you, often we pay the bills and then are paid back, right? We're being reimbursed. So when we talk about things like the funding freeze, what's very challenging for us, especially when the technology is barring us from drawing down funds, is we've already spent the money because we signed a legal agreement that we would spend the money on certain things. And if we can't recoup what has already been spent in a good faith business relationship, that in turn causes institutional problems for every nonprofit. And again, I'm noting that the state of Alaska is probably navigating some of those realities as well. So I think the role of employment being impacted in the federal government just slogs the bureaucracy down, and it makes every project take a little bit longer, particularly the more innovative things that Alaskans were hoping to see with hard infrastructure development.
Thank you, Ms. Boyle. Representative Underwood?
Yes, this goes to the gentleman from AFGE. I'm sorry I didn't get your last name, but thank you so much for all that you do for our veterans. I just was wondering if you have had the opportunity or your office to speak with our congressional delegation, one in particular being a veteran themselves, just to see if you've had any dialogue expressing how this has affected our veterans here in the state of Alaska, and if you've had any conversations yet for any pathways forward specifically for our veterans.
Yes, ma'am. I've heard frequently from Senator Murkowski's office and some from Senator Sullivan. I have not heard anything from our new congressman, Mr. Begich. But like I say, I had a longstanding and heartfelt relationship with the late Congressman Young and learned so much from him. I also learned how not to come into his office unprepared. nobody does that. Luckily, it was the person that went before me, not myself. But no one cared about the veterans in Alaska more than Don Young. And I will say the opportunity, having met with Senator Stevens the first time I went to D.C., was very rewarding. And that I really appreciate Senator Sullivan and Senator Murkowski fighting to increase the number of VA employees to take care of our veterans. Very grateful to them for their support and their service towards veterans. But right now, with the the problem, if I might say, is the word being thrown out there is voluntary resignations. No, it's voluntary resignment. And the problem that we're also looking at, the state may look at, is the federal government is funded till March, and if that funding does not continue, it's quite possible from the union's perspective that those resignations could be terminated much sooner than September. Because they're really, if you read the language that the union has looked at, there is no obligation to continue keeping those people on the books till September. And I don't know about you, but I've never heard of paying somebody to not work for 7 months. And that's the savings. Find it hard to believe.
Thank you, Mr. Traver. I'm going to re-ask Representative Underwood's question for everyone who's online. If there are any updates from meetings or phone calls with the federal delegation over the past week that could perhaps provide any updates or I guess clarifications about the current state of federal funding and our nonprofits and other organizations that depend on federal funding for their day-to-day operations. Oh, okay. Jasmine Boyle from Rural Cap has her hand up if you want to go first.
Yep, and I'm happy to cede the path to a number of other partners on the phone who may have more current information. Senator Murkowski's staff and the senator herself were on the phone with Alaska Monday night. They had three different work sessions. I was involved in two, and I believe Vivian, Julie, and Jocelyn may have been involved in the other. But they had a conversation with tribal organizations and tribal leaders, a separate conversation with impacted nonprofits around the state, and a third conversation in partnership with the Alaska Municipal League with state and local government officials. And so my understanding is the senator's team is compiling the feedback. I know they're working with Foraker and AML on some of the data that we're all trying to encourage folks to use the Foraker website to contribute. So there'll probably be a metadata analysis. And then I heard Vivian mention this earlier as well. There were qualitative comments that were also provided to the senator. And she gave Alaskans until 5 Alaska time today to provide any additional impacts we would like in writing. So I'm certainly not privy to what they're talking about behind the scenes, but I'm imagining that she's going to have a pretty comprehensive set of data that might be useful to this committee or to the state government at large. We attempted to reach out to the other members of our congressional delegation, and I know Senator Sullivan reached out to several tribal leaders we worked with directly. We haven't seen a larger attempt at data collection broadly, but we just might not have been included, and others on the call may have better information. But no clear guidance from them at this time, just their interest in hearing from Alaskans so that they can do the work in D.C.
Thank you, Ms. Boyle. And just a note for anyone else who may speak on Teams, if you could please put yourself on the record to help with our record keeping, that would be great. Are there any further questions from committee members, or was there anyone else online who wanted to give an update about any guidance they'd received from the federal delegation that's more recent than last Monday? Oh, Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, I have one question for Mr. Traver. Through the chair, thank you for your service and for your ongoing work post-retirement to serve our veterans. I'm curious if the union, you know, in this time of the deferred resignation, if the union is providing any additional support or resources to assist your employees at this time.
The union does provide for our dues paying members legal resources. Are we able to provide financial resources? Larger locals that have 3,000 members or more are in a better position than mine, or the one that the union that I ran, to be able to financially assist members. What we've tried to do is provide them with links to service organizations, but the problem is will those service organizations be able to help our? We have many single parents, disabled veterans that depend on a lot of the nonprofits within the community for services. This is going to have a chilling impact on them as well. I understand what you're asking. I don't have the ability to provide I didn't have the ability to provide funds to help them during these difficult times, if that's what you're asking. The best that we could do as a union is we do have legal teams in D.C. that are gearing up to fight some of the executive orders and the impact that they're going to have on our employees as far as due process. In our particular case, the VA, we already have a contract, so in some ways we're safe, but we're not. No employee is safe, especially that is non-clinical. I honestly feel that. And we are just preparing to open up a new mental health wing, and which I'm grateful to the senators for their support in getting that funding, but will we be able to staff it? That's a really good question. And these are services that our veterans desperately need.
Thank you.
Are there any final questions from the committee? If not, I want to thank all of our presenters for being present today and for their presentations. This concludes today's meeting of the House Judiciary Committee. On Wednesday, we'll be hearing House Bill 62, Sexual Assault Examination Kits Tracking, for the first time, and then hear a presentation from the Alaska Court System on therapeutic courts. And on Friday, we'll be hearing amendments and public testimony on House Bill 48, Civil Legal Services Fund. The time is 2:54 p.m., and this hearing of the House Judiciary Committee is now adjourned.